LLC. Mr. Pikey, good morning to you.
Good morning. Please, court, I represent Janice M. Henderson Egan, or Pikey. I'll refer to Janice M. Henderson Egan, JMH. This is a fraudulent transfer case. Back in, prior to January of 2011, JMH operated an insurance agency in Elm Creek, Nebraska. In January of 2011, JMH sold 90% of its assets to a corporation known as Risk Asset and Management, Inc. I refer to them as RAM. At the time, RAM defaulted on the asset purchase agreement. JMH then went into district court and obtained a judgment against RAM in the amount of $100,000 or less. JMH attempted to execute on that judgment. They were thwarted initially by the bankruptcy of RAM. It was pending for quite a while, eventually dismissed. JMH then filed a replevin action in county court, also filed a request for a charging order in district court. While these actions were pending, RAM changed its name. Same business it operated in, same insurance business in Elm Creek, simply changed its name. There was a transaction by which it bought RAM, sold its customer list for $250 to the new corporation, which was an LLC.
When JMH left the partnership, did that client list also go? Was the client list taken then as well?
Was the client list taken?
After JMH left the partnership.
Right. Did JMH
have access to or control over that client list?
Not control.
Access to?
This is very complicated by the fact that JMH still owned 10% of the assets. Not 10% of any particular assets, just 10% generally of the assets. All the agency contracts, client list, all the contracts were in the name of the partnership. JMH was a 10% partner in the partnership. Essentially, the only client that she took, that JMH took, was the client that was solely in the name of JMH's president. Did she have access to the others? I suppose so, but they were in the name of PBIA, and RAM continued the operation of PBIA.
Thank you.
Was there a non-compete agreement between RAM and JMH?
There was not.
Was the sale accomplished in two contracts, one for pending insurance and a separate contract for incentives with respect to future contracts?
No, it was simply an asset purchase agreement.
Okay.
And then after the asset purchase agreement, they entered into a partnership agreement that was operated by the agency. Our contention is that this transfer of this change of name to an LLC was a fraudulent transfer under 36-705 and 36-706. And there.
Counsel, what was the evidence of the value of the assets transferred on October 28, 2013?
I'm sorry?
What was the evidence presented by you as to the value of the assets transferred on October 28, 2013?
First of all, the assets were transferred about 2.5 years after RAM paid $104,000. In his pretrial deposition, the president of RAM admitted that the assets transferred were the exact same assets purchased for $104,000. That's one element of evidence. The second is, an accountant testified that in 2012, the agency, or RAM, took from the agency $80,000 in net commissions. In 2013, the first 10 months of 2015, RAM took about $47,000 worth of net commissions. That was the evidence as to the value.
Did you present any evidence or have any testimony specifically as to what the value was?
We did not have an expert come in and evaluate the business and give an estimate as to this X value of the business.
Did the court find a fraudulent transfer?
Not specifically.
Is that a problem?
I don't think so. I think you've got to read between the lines. It doesn't come out and say there was a fraudulent, was or was not a fraudulent transfer. But I think if you read what the court is saying, well, if there was a fraudulent transfer, the most in the value of the asset transfer. Well,
back up a little. The court is saying there is or is not a fraudulent transfer, either directly with a decision or implication.
Only by implication.
There's an award.
I'm sorry?
There's an award of $250.
So by implication, there must have been a fraudulent transfer.
And so on what basis do you believe the court found the fraudulent transfer, such as to make an award?
The court didn't specify that. Mm-hmm. We're contending two bases. First, an actual intent to defraud, and the statute lists various badges of fraud. We think many of those apply in this case. There's a judgment pending against RAM. There's other litigation pending as well to collect on that judgment. At the time of the transfer, all of the assets of RAM were transferred. Transfer rendered RAM insolvent afterwards.
Was there a reasonable equivalent value paid for the assets? That's the $250,
so.
Right?
I don't think so.
Okay.
The evidence I just indicated as to the value of the corporation, or value of the assets, indicates that $250 was not a reasonable equivalent value.
That's because it generated net commissions of $80,000 in 2012? Is that the argument?
Not generating $80,000 in commissions, netting
$80,000. I used the term net commissions.
Yeah, netting $80,000.
Correct.
Right. And $47,000 the first 10 months of 2013, indicating this was an asset of substantial value, generating that kind of income.
Let me back up here and see if we can decipher the court's order, which is part of my problem here. If the court is finding a fraudulent transfer, the $250 wasn't enough for the asset, and then gets down to doing an award and says, well, that $250 is the value, there's a disconnect, isn't there? It's not enough, and here's what it's worth. Help me out.
I'm not sure I can. The court was not very specific in what it decided. It didn't come out and say it was or wasn't a fraudulent transfer. What the court said was, at most, I'm not saying one way or the other, but at most, your value is $250, and that's what we're going to award you.
And that's what was paid for.
That's what was paid for.
So that wouldn't meet the criteria of 36706A, which would be not a reasonably equivalent value. There's a fraudulent transfer.
I'm sorry, I lost you.
Okay. If you don't pay enough, that's one of the elements of a fraudulent transfer.
Of the portion of the statute I didn't get to. I think you don't even have to get to that because there was an actual intent here. You don't need the equivalent value portion of the statute.
That's your path. You go down to the badges of fraud.
That's right.
Okay, that's right. Where you would start in your trip through the statute.
That's where I would start.
Okay.
That doesn't get me home. I think you go to the reasonably equivalent value.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr. Norton? Good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Nicholas Norton. I represent the appellee, Messrs. And Ventures, as well as RAM. RAM is a defunct entity at this point. Messrs. And Ventures is the operating entity. I want to address a few things that came up during appellant's argument first. The question was asked whether JMH had continued access to the customer list. The record shows that she did, and that indeed, after she began competing actively against the partnership, she was using that customer list to access customers and to try to write business, continue relationships outside of PBIA partnership. With regard to the evidence on what this customer list, what these agency contracts were worth, the only direct evidence in that trial, and that's reflected in the record, is that it was worth $250. That is the price that was paid for it. There was evidence that that particular item was that Mr. Messersmith, through RAM, paid $104,000 for that item 2.5 years.
Was there a finding of a fraudulent transfer? How do you read the order? How do you get an award in a fraudulent transfer case without a fraudulent transfer having been found?
Exactly. You can't. And I think to your point a few minutes ago, under Section 36706, where a reasonably equivalent value is required, then it is impossible for this transfer to have been fraudulent if $250 was the reasonable value.
So this is the disconnect I'm puzzled by.
Right.
If the court found that it was a reasonably equivalent value, $250 is a reasonable value, then there is no fraudulent transfer. Is that correct?
Well, there's certainly no fraudulent transfer under Section 706.
Right.
And I think what appellant was leaning towards in his argument is that doesn't necessarily foreclose a fraudulent transfer under 705. Now, we don't believe that there was a fraudulent transfer at all, but even if the court found that there was a fraudulent transfer under 705, the value of the asset is still very important, because one of the remedies that the appellant asked for was avoidance of the transfer. Well, if you look at Section 708, that's one of the remedies they're allowed to ask for. And 709 says that what the court may award as judgment if avoidance of the contract or of the transfer is sought is the value of the asset transferred. And so that gets us back to this $250. There was no accountant that said this is what it's worth today. There was no insurance agent who said, if I were buying the agency, this is what I would pay for it. That evidence is not in the record. Now, what it was worth 2.5 years before this happened doesn't take into account all that happened between them.
But this asset, if asset it be, is generating commissions.
Sure, and I kind of liken that to a very fancy Leica camera. If I have a really nice camera, I might be able to go out and take some pretty pictures, but that doesn't make me a photographer. A photographer could take the same camera and generate millions of dollars a year. I might be able to generate some wall art for my office. That has nothing to do with the value of the camera. It's the value of the person using the camera.
Was this an asset that was transferred?
In the colloquial sense of the term, I suppose it's an asset. Under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, I do not believe it's an asset.
What have other courts said with respect to insurance book of business composed of agency contracts and client contracts?
Well, in a book of business with regard to insurance agencies, it's been classified as either a general intangible or an account.
Under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, do the majority of courts say this kind of thing is an asset?
I believe they do.
So why do you say it's not?
Because under the definitional section of the UFTA, an asset is a type of property, but it's not an asset if it's encumbered by a valid lien. In this case, this asset...
If it's over-encumbered.
Well, if it's fully encumbered. If there's equity in the asset, then or in the book of business or in whatever's subject to the lien, then that equity is an asset that can be transferred pursuant to the UFTA. If there's no equity, then there's no asset. If there's no asset, then there's no transfer, by definition. So the only evidence as to what this book of business is worth is $250. Exhibit 43 in the record indicates that the total indebtedness of RAM in this case was approximately $37,000. Appellant had some interesting math in the reply brief to try to make that fit, but I don't think there's any way that you can get over that.
For what was $104,000 paid for initially?
You know, on paper...
If not the client list, what was it?
It was to get a foot in the door in a new market. You know, Ram was coming into an existing agency and was benefiting from access to that customer list through introductions to the insurance companies.
And contracts with agency contracts.
Agency contracts, but the agency
And the
contracts,
deal that was between JMH and Ram, was it structured in one contract or two?
I believe it was in one contract.
So y'all didn't differentiate between current pending policies as opposed to future policies?
I'm not aware of any differentiation in that regard.
Thank you.
Tell me about the encumbrance.
Well, there were a series of UCC financing statements filed by Exchange Bank, two of which are not really relevant to this particular issue, but one was filed in February of 2013 when Ram borrowed some money.
How much did they borrow?
I believe that note may have been $1,000.
What was the collateral for that?
Well, part of the collateral was everything that Ram had.
Which was?
Which was the insurance business. It would have been...
The book of business?
The book of business would have been a part of that. The furniture, fixtures, everything in the office. Just all personal property.
So the book of business was an asset for collateral purpose?
It was.
Okay.
And
it had at least a value of $22,000 to secure the note.
Well, if that were the only asset securing the note, then maybe, but there's no evidence in the record as to what any of that other stuff was worth. That security agreement, or the security financing statement, listed all property now or hereafter acquired, as well as several specific categories, including general intangibles and accounts, which is what all of the case law that we've been able to locate lists customer lists or agency contracts under. There was some dispute, and it's noted in the briefs that the appellant had a security interest as well, and there was a finding by the court in a related case that they had a superior security interest with regard to the specific things enumerated in their financing statement. Those specific things don't include general intangibles or accounts, and the court noted in that order that it wasn't deciding priority between Exchange Bank and the appellant. So I think that's the basis by which this isn't an asset, and it's impossible to say, well, because that was one item of collateral or in a security agreement, it must have been worth what the loan amount was. This was a business that was generating money. The bank obviously thought that they were a good bet to pay back their loan, and I think that's all we can infer from that.
Would you infer that the bank was more impressed by the book of business than the furniture?
Potentially. My inference would be, you know, if I go and see a banker and say I need a business loan, what that banker's going to ask me is, how are you going to succeed? How are you going to pay back this loan? And what I would take from getting the loan in the first place is that the banker was satisfied that Ram was going to be profitable and pay back their loan. I don't think that's necessarily tied to just a customer list.
Is that tied to an income stream?
I would imagine so. That's what I would look at if I were a banker.
And where's the income stream come from for Ram or Messersmith?
Well, it comes from the relationships that they're building with the individuals and businesses that they're writing policies for.
Certainly those company names, book of business?
The book of business would kind of be the, you know, in the way that book of business is used in this case, the way that we use it in the briefing, it consists of the agency contracts and the customer lists. That's a visual representation of the business, but I don't think that it's, man, finish this thought, I don't think that that's necessarily what the business is. The business is the relationships that are reflected by the names on that list. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
We have a minute and 9.
A minute and 9 seconds. Mr. Bikey.
I did go back and look at the Clerk's Journal entry, and the court talked about
transfer being voidable, and then the litigant can recover a judgment. I would say by implication, if the court ordered a judgment, the court ordered or found that the transfer was voidable.
From whom are you seeking the judgment?
I'm sorry?
From whom are you seeking the judgment?
I didn't, the plaintiff did not seek a judgment, a monetary judgment. The court awarded a monetary judgment. We were seeking to impose a charging order against the new entity.
Of how much? Charging order of how much?
The amount of our judgment. Although we didn't specify in the complaint the amount. It would necessarily be whatever we could recover of our judgment. A $100,000 judgment.
And because those assets were transferred to Messerschmitt, then you think that Messerschmitt now owes you $100,000?
Messerschmitt Ventures, LLC, yes.
Okay.
The bottom line of our argument here is it's a $100,000 judgment. $100,000 judgment, you shouldn't be able to avoid that judgment simply by changing your name and continuing the same business.
Thank you very much. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is actually five cases consolidated for argument. Those are In Re Interest of Luz P., In Re Interest of Jonathan V., In Re Interest of Eva D.,